Good morning, and may it please the Court. Devin Hine representing Appellant Daniel Gonzalez. Mr. Gonzalez was 20 years old when he was when the passenger in his car fired one shot at a group of rival gang members.
Counsel, we have read the briefs. We know what the facts are, and I would appreciate your addressing the issue that is of concern to me, and that is about juror number three. Mm-hmm. What questions were asked in voir dire that should have prompted juror number three to reveal the gang incident that had involved her brother and to reveal her anxiety?
I'm sorry, I don't have an exact cite to the question in voir dire, but but the question that the court acknowledged that she didn't answer was whether anyone that she knew had been a victim of a violent crime. And I also imagine whether she knew anyone from the that was listed on the witness list. Now, it is true that juror number three said she didn't recognize the name of the detective who investigated her brother's, the case involving her brother and her brother's friend. But regarding whether or not she knew any victims of violent crime, this would have revealed the stabbing incident, the bombing, and the bombing incident, which was actually in her own driveway. Those questions both should have elicited that information from her.
But when the trial judge found out about it, he disqualified her, replaced her, and told him to start deliberations over with.
Right.
Right?
And I do want to.
What else should he have done?
Well, given that what she said was possibly prejudicial, it triggered a requirement to investigate further and to hold a hearing, and to determine what, if any, effect her statements to the jury had before simply admonishing them not to consider it, because the court says it didn't find misconduct, but at the same time it told them to disregard what she said. If what she said if what she said was improper and therefore needed to be disregarded, then its effect on the jury also needed to be investigated, and that's under Remmer and under other Supreme Court law that requires that the court take all proper steps for due process sake to determine the effect of extraneous information.
Doesn't the Remmer and the other have to do with jurors bringing something other than their own experiences into the jury room? Certainly agree that she should have disclosed this, but don't those cases have to do with when they bring something other than their own experiences in the courtroom, by they've talked to somebody or they've done some research?
Well, I would say, Your Honors, that while that's, while it is true that Remmer addresses that very specifically, this court actually held in Godoy and made clear that there's no indication that Remmer is limited only to certain particular kinds of misconduct. Rather, when their misconduct appears prejudicial, there needs to be further inquiry. I also say this court's held on several occasions that whether or not information is outside information depends on its nature, not its source. So, here where the juror was telling detailed and inflammatory stories of crimes that were not necessarily similar to those testified to at trial by the gang expert, that was extraneous information which was misconduct to introduce and which should have triggered further inquiry. I would also say here that what juror number three did by imparting all this information to the rest of the jurors was acting as basically putting herself out there as an additional expert witness against these gangs and saying that she knew how they conducted themselves, that she had these examples to support that she knew that they conducted themselves this way, and that they would kill people without remorse. The evidence
one,
of intent
one,
in this...
One question I had about that... She expressed fear for herself as a result, as I understand it, as a result of these events. And if the other jurors were affected by that, isn't it more likely that they would have not convicted because they didn't want to incur the wrath of the gang?
I disagree, Your Honor. I think what this information would have done is to inflame a jury, as it typically does, to get these bad guys, to put these guys away because they're these kind of people. And that was at the center of this case. Here, this, and I want to also point out again, right, that my client, petitioner, appellant, was the driver of the, in this case. He was not found to be armed. He was not found, he denied knowing that his co-defendant was armed, and the police stated that into the record. And he had never been in trouble before. Even the gang expert said he'd never, he wasn't aware of him prior to this case. So the evidence of his specific intent for anyone to be killed was very sparse. And to let this juror then give this additional expert testimony about how gangs conduct themselves and how easily they would kill someone really could have, what could have prejudiced my client with regard to the intent issue, which was, again, central.
Should juror number three have not relayed that information? In other words, if a juror knows something that's relevant, their common sense, their common life experiences, are they not to contribute that to part of deliberation?
I don't think that's the issue here. They're certainly supposed to, and that's why I think this
the issue here is she didn't disclose it. No.
I think that, I think the issue is two parts. Because she didn't disclose it during voir dire, she committed misconduct by failing to say something that could have gotten her removed for cause. At the same time, when a person conceals information on voir dire, it then makes it impossible for those biases to be filtered out before they make it into the deliberations. I think a good example here is the case where even in voir dire, when a witness kept saying that she was an expert on allegations of abuse, and that in her opinion, every time a child came forward with allegations of abuse, they were telling the truth, or that she, in her experience rather, that that was true, that was considered misconduct, and it was considered possibly prejudicial, which again would have triggered a further inquiry here. It wasn't sufficient at that point to simply admonish the jury not to consider whatever they had heard.
I want to get back briefly. You said a hearing should have been held prior to verdict?
Yes, and I think that issue...
Sorry, are you saying that if we were to remand the case back to the judge to conduct a hearing of the jurors as to what, if any, impact this had on their verdict, that wouldn't be sufficient relief for you at this time?
I would say that it would. The issue here is also that there was a... this would have triggered a presumption of prejudice that never was applied. So I suppose to say that it would be impossible to say that this failure to hold a hearing was harmless, because the government would have been required under Remmer to rebut the presumption of prejudice, which they can't do with the evidence on the record. So
maybe I wasn't clear. What I want to know is, are you wanting us to overturn the conviction and give a new trial, or are you wanting us to order the district judge to do the hearing that you requested that you didn't get?
I think here, Mr. Gonzalez is entitled to a new trial, because as I said, this prejudice, if we stopped at that presumption of prejudice because the court failed to reach that, which it should have, then there was never any effort to rebut that presumption. So if I could address also briefly the question then of the ineffective assistance. Here, the issue with the ineffective assistance issue is that it seems clear that it would have been easy and simple for the counsel to get a declaration from the juror, the foreperson. The reason that it matters here is that the court cites Dykes several times for the proposition that it was free to disregard the statements in the report due to them being unsworn hearsay. And when you look at the court's language denying the motion for a new trial, he repeatedly says that he's hearkening back to his previous holding. So it's not clear from the record here whether or not the court was saying, independent of that report, that his holdings were still correct, or because he did not consider that report, his holdings were still correct. And I think that that is a reason that, at the very least, a hearing is required on the ineffective assistance claim as to prejudice.
And what would we do at the hearing?
At the hearing, we need to know whether or not the court denied the motion for a new trial because he didn't have it.
We would call the trial judge in? We were to hold a hearing. Who are we going to call?
That's a fair question, Your Honor. I suppose we wouldn't call the trial judge, so we would have to determine. But then I guess if you can't have a hearing on this claim, it would also be impossible to say that the conduct wasn't harmless, so then you would require relief if a hearing is not appropriate.
Did you want to save some rebuttal time?
I will. I could briefly address one thing regarding, I know you had asked me to focus on those two points, but if I could briefly address the insufficient evidence claim. I understand that there is the concern of AEDPA double deference, but at the same time, it's known not to be insurmountable, as this court held in Juan H. And here, where the Court of Appeal itself basically said that it was speculating as to where the people were positioned, but that they could nonetheless find support that anyone was in this direct line of fire, I think is patently unreasonable, and therefore would also warrant overturning the conviction. And if the Court has no further questions at this time, I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Michael Keller for the Warden. I think the first thing that's important in looking at the juror misconduct claim is to think about what type of claim this is. There's the tampering type claim, which is what you had in Remmer, an outside influence coming in or maybe an internet search. That's one type of juror misconduct.
Well, this misconduct claim has to do with the juror not revealing in response to questions that she had personal experience with violent crime and specifically with this gang that's involved in this case. And it would seem to me that would be misconduct not to reveal that information. And it, to me, speaking only for myself, once that information came forward, once the jury foreperson said, well, this person is scared and she knows about this gang, not to ask the other jurors, one by one, what was said and, you know, can you really leave this behind? It just struck me as perhaps an insufficient response.
So what I would say is the intentional concealment or concealment during jury selection leads to an inference that the juror may be biased. And in this case, if juror 3 sat on the jury, then the issue would be one of bias. But since juror 3 was removed, we're left with...
How did her comments affect the jurors who remained, which is pretty important, depending on what she said and how it affected them? And we don't know because there wasn't a hearing.
Well, what we do know is what she said, and we do know the context of what she said and why she said it, and that's important here. So that becomes a question of a juror. Ultimately, what we have is we have a juror who shared a personal experience from 10 years ago, and in this court, in Grota Mayor, has said, jurors talk about personal experiences all the time. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well, it depends on what the personal experience is. If the personal experience were, I didn't tell you, you know, in voir dire that I actually know 3 of the witnesses, and they are terrific people, and I'll give you an example because I, you know, one of them gave me a birthday party, and, you know, those are all personal experiences, but they're not proper. And so to me, the question is, how do we know what effect this had on the remaining jurors as to whether they felt they needed to put this bad guy away?
So I absolutely agree. The question is, when we look at the personal experience, is it offered? And when we're talking, this is whether it's extrinsic evidence. And the problem with extrinsic evidence is it's allowing uncross-examined, unsworn testimony to come before the jury through one juror telling another jury something. So the question is, was this, for instance, if she had said, I know the defendant and he's violent. Okay.
And here she says, my brother testified at a trial involving these gangs, and then they tried to, you know, then they bombed his car in my driveway, right?
So it didn't involve petitioner. It didn't involve petitioner's gang. And in context, it wasn't offered to, so like, if you look at the Estrada case was where somebody talked about a personal experience, a person was released from custody, got out and committed a homicide. So the personal experience, if someone's sharing it and saying, that's why I'm afraid, that's one thing. But in Estrada, what the person did, the juror did, was say, we should convict this person of the most serious crime so they get a long sentence.
But regardless of what specific words were said, shouldn't we know what the other remaining jurors understood from what she said, or how they reacted to what she said, whether it affected their view of the case?
Well, it's consistent both with what Juror 3 said and the foreperson's note. The foreperson's note said that Juror 3 was explaining, there was a conversation that occurred in the jury deliberations
room. Right,
wasn't feeling well, and they inquired, and that's when she revealed and came clean with what happened. So in context, both Juror 3 was talking about her own personal fear, and the jury foreperson was interpreting it as an explanation of a fear, not as
That's one juror. That's my problem. What do the other jurors think?
But if it's offered about fear, in other words, I'm really concerned and here's why, how I don't even understand how the other jurors could use it as deciding the case. In other words, it's not like this other gang committed a crime against me, so you should convict these petitioners. Nothing like that was said or offered. So there's basically no indication of any misconduct at all. And when we look at these types of situations in Tracy, that's where one of the things that opposing counsel had said that the Remmer standard in terms of what it requires to hold a hearing applies in all the different contexts, and that's just not simply true. In Tracy, this court said that Remmer's command about hearings is unique to the tampering context where the potential effect on the jury is severe. Tampering was not at issue in Tracy's case. This isn't a tampering case, so Remmer doesn't apply, so we're left with, is there any material difference between how Juror 3 is describing the situation that occurred and the foreperson? No. Is there anything that is especially severe in terms of what's being revealed? Like if she had said the defendant has a prior record, the defendant has a reputation for violence? No, it's nothing like that that has a severe severe indication that there's going to be prejudice.
Let me ask you, if during the jury selection process, juror number 3 had stood up and said to the entire jury selection panel exactly what she said, we know she said in the jury room, she wouldn't have been placed on the jury. You agree with that?
Absolutely.
And the judge then in his instructions would said to the jury who did get impaneled, you decide your case solely on the evidence you hear in trial, right?
Yes.
So the judge ultimately did tell the jury not to disregard everything juror number 3 said. Is that correct?
That is correct.
How do we know if the jury did that if we don't ask them?
Well, in the example that you gave, if it happens in jury selection, I fully expect it would have gone just as you said, Your Honor. I don't think the judge would have said, this jury can't be, an instruction won't work here. I'm going to have to send up a new panel and we're going to have to start over because this is just so prejudicial. I think he would have gone forward with an admonition, and this is the same type of situation. And in Estrada, this court identified five different things that give us an indication as to whether or not extrinsic evidence is the kind of thing that will taint the other jurors. And the first point is, how was the material received? So in this case, again, the material was offered and received not as to, we should decide the case a certain way.
We don't know that. We don't know how it was received. That's the very premise of the claim on appeal.
Well, we know what it was offered for, both by the foreperson and they're in alignment. There's no.
That's two of them, and there are a whole lot of other people on the jury.
But we know what was said, and
right.
We know the context in which it was given. Otherwise, anything else would just be fishing to see if somebody else may have some other view of it and we should use it in some bizarre way. And then I'd go to the second point.
You think it's bizarre to say when you learn about how terrible gang violence is and how upsetting it is to somebody that they won't take that into account?
Well, what I think is that jurors already understand gangs are incredibly dangerous. That's a matter of common knowledge. I think the fact that a gang committed a crime 10 years ago isn't all that prejudicial, particularly given the fact that this is a gang shooting and the fact that you had the expert testify that petitioner's gang, the Brown family, not the gang involved in the prior, that the Brown family's primary activities, the thing they do all the time, is shootings. So I don't think it would be something that would be seen as, wow, this is new information about gangs, that gangs actually commit crimes. I think that's something that jurors know. Additionally, the second point that this court has looked to is the length of time something's available to the jury, the extrinsic evidence. And in this case, it wasn't available to them for a very short time because what happened was Juror 3 came clean about her fear. The foreperson sent the note. Juror 3 was removed. New deliberations with a new jury. And the third prong is the extent to which it was discussed. The record contains absolutely no indication that the jury ever discussed this.
It contains no information on that because there was no hearing. It's just, I mean, you're sort of bootstrapping, it seems to me, to say, well, the record doesn't tell us these bad things because there's no record. That just seems like circular to me.
But that would be true of every case. In other words, we don't know if there was misconduct, if the jury discussed something they shouldn't have. Should we bring in every jury and discuss? I mean, in this case, there's no indication that and they filed the motion for a new trial on this. And was there any indication?
We know that. That's why we're here.
Yeah. And the foreperson didn't indicate that it was ever discussed. I don't think there should be a supposition that they did discuss it. And at what point was it discussed? Not just before they reached a verdict. It was discussed, and then that juror was excused, and then the new jury, and they deliberated for 3.5 hours, more than 3.5 hours after that new jury was constituted. So I think, and then the final prong is other matters. And again, that encompasses sort of the context of how this was offered. This wasn't Juror 3 saying, we should get these guys because of what happened to my brother. Nothing like that was said. Nothing like that was... And the foreperson didn't interpret it that way. I would also point out that opposing counsel cited the Godoy case. Again, Godoy is a tampering type situation. It's totally different from somebody sharing a personal experience. There simply isn't a Supreme Court case that would say that it's unreasonable to hold a hearing in this type of situation. In terms of what would happen at a hearing, Your Honor asked about that. I guess the things that would, and I would point out that in their reply brief, she was asking today for no hearing, that there should be relief, but her briefing
it's
is
pretty difficult to put that genie back in the bottle here. If we thought that a hearing should have been held, we really don't have any discretion other than to order habeas relief and have him retried, right? Is there anything short of that the state could propose?
Well, in Remmer, they actually held a hearing, and it found in the district court later made factual findings and found that it was harmless, or it didn't happen. But there was a hearing held in Remmer, and then relief was ultimately denied.
Yeah, those were about facts. But you're now asking people to reconstruct dialogue. How long ago was this trial?
I don't remember how many years ago it was.
Yeah. More than 10?
Could have been about that.
Okay.
You would then have to find
the jurors, if you could find them, bring them in and ask them what happened in the jury room in something, in a matter that's, 10 to 15 years old.
Yeah. That would be definitely
a little bit of an uphill slog, wouldn't it?
Well, it just would be, it would be difficult, but you certainly, one thing that you can't do is talk about, in this case, the foreperson said that in their motion for a new trial said that it didn't affect and wasn't part of their,
But as Judge Graber points out, that was the foreperson.
Yeah.
We didn't get into the minds of anybody else. Nobody else was interviewed.
Right. But there's just no indication that
Right, because nobody else was talked to. We have another 10 jurors who are in that room who know something about it, and we're not asked what happened.
And the question ultimately before this court isn't whether it would have been preferable or advisable to hold a hearing. The question is whether or not it violated U.S. Supreme Court precedent to do
right.
so.
That's
whether
that.
And I think under the AEDPA maybe it would have been preferable, but it was reasonable for the court to say, I can cure this with an instruction. And the district court judgment properly applied the AEDPA. I would ask this court to affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you have some rebuttal time remaining.
Thank you. So the first point I want to address is that opposing counsel pointed out that that all of these other instances were jury tampering cases, including Godoy. So I'd like to direct the court to footnote 6 of Godoy, where the court specifically states that any outside contact raising a credible risk of influencing the verdict triggers the presumption of prejudice.
And Godoy is our case?
Yes.
Okay. That doesn't help you very much, because this is AEDPA.
Right, but this is, I understand that, but they...
So what Supreme Court case should the California courts have looked to that would have alerted them that the trial judge had to conduct a hearing in this
case? It would have been Remmer, because the case
but
was
Remmer
possibly...
But Remmer is quite different.
But that's it is a, the question that's a, of Remmer...
That's a tampering case.
But the question remained whether or not the contact was possibly prejudicial, which would have then triggered a presumption of prejudice that the state had to rebut. Here, we know that the contact was possibly prejudicial. That's why the court told them not to consider it. And I think also to look to, if we also look at what was discussed in Godoy, it's the question of whether possibly prejudicial can even be squared with the standard that the state trial and appellate court applied, which is this requirement of a strong possibility of prejudicial misconduct. So when the court says there's no misconduct, looking at it in context, not to say that the court was actually applying that strong possibility standard to the phrase prejudicial misconduct as a whole, not just misconduct. And holding petitioners to the burden of strong possibility directly conflicted with clearly established federal law in that regard as well. I also wanted to just note that because of that presumption, the issue of all the things that aren't in the record were the state's burden to repair at that point. So to say that it would be an uphill battle to prove that it was harmless is absolutely right. It would be an uphill battle, and that and one in this case that isn't even necessary, and I think would be more advisable to grant relief on the issue. I know the court was looking. The case was about 10 years ago. That's correct. And the last thing I did want to point out here too is that it's also unreasonable under almost any standard to have taken the approach that the court did, because the trial court relied solely on the statements of a person who had just lied to the court about their experiences during voir dire, who had spent a whole day and a half in the jury room before someone finally pointed out, or before someone was finally able to point out that she had been concealing all this information. And then he relied solely on her statements about what she said in the jury room, which weren't even really that clear, to decide that there was no reason for a hearing. I think that's unreasonable under any standard, that to start and end the inquiry with her when she herself was already an unreliable narrator of what was going on and trying to probably protect herself. So I would like to say for that reason and for the reasons I previously discussed, the proper thing here, I think, is to grant Mr. Gonzalez habeas relief, because the court failed to hold a hearing when information this prejudicial was imparted to the entire jury.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate very much the arguments from both of you, and the case just argued is submitted.